This is the SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award winner. And we are back for another round of podcastery shenanigans. I made that word up just for John Stevens. Just as a reminder, this is a Hugo nomination season that we're in right now. If you and everyone else listening to this podcast went out and voted, it would change the whole Hugo landscape. People within the SFNF community talk about change all the time. Well, here's your chance to actually make change happen. If you'd like to know more about the Hugos and how the voting works, visit www.thehugoawards.org. You don't actually have to attend the Hugos or Worldcon to make nominations or vote. You can purchase a supporting membership at luncon3.org/memberships. And if you attended Worldcon in San Antonio, you are already eligible to nominate people and works for the Hugo Awards. There are a lot of great podcasts out there who are eligible, including this very one you're listening to right now, and the other podcasts hosted by SF Signal. Which include SF Crossing the Gulf and Something About Some Horsemen. The folks on this very podcast all have works out there and different things that they have done that make them eligible for various awards. So this is your chance to affect change and make their day. It's all in your hands. Now, on to our topic, sequels. Now, we've all read books or seen movies that were okay. Not great, just okay. We've also read books or seen movies that were awesome. Both, however, left us wanting more. And then came the sequel that was so much better than the first, like at the movies with Empire Strikes Back or Aliens, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, The Road Warrior, The Dark Knight, and, of course, Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Stop taking all my examples.
Everyone on the podcast panel is now panicking because they were thinking about books. And that's cool. This topic is pretty broad and can include any media that you like. But I am limiting everyone to just that's a different commercial. Name up to five sequels that were better than the first book and why. We're going to go down the list and say hello to folks. Let's start off with Mr. Paul Weimer.
Hi, my name is Paul Weimer. I'm an author, a blogger. I write for SF Signal, The Functional Nerds. I'm a co-host on Skiffy and Fandy. I am all over the internet.
What's Skiffy and Fandy?
Skiffy and Fandy is a podcast run by Sean Duke, Jen Zink, Julia Rios, and me, with contributions by Mike Underwood, David Annandale, and others.
Hey, I was on a panel with Julia Rios. She's very nice.
She is our secret mastermind of organizing stuff. She is awesome.
Very cool. What else were you going to say before I interrupted you?
I am indeed eligible for the Hugo Award for Best Fan Writer. I guess technically my one story I wrote in 2012 would 2013 would be eligible, although only about 30 people read it. But that's beside the point.
Hey, you know what? That's 30 people who otherwise wouldn't have read it. So that's just 30 people that you touched, and you didn't do it inappropriately, so that's good.
That's true.
Next up, let's say hello to Larry, who has been absent for quite some time.
Larry.
Hey, I've been on the road. What can I say? I'm actually at home for a change, and I'm very happy to be here. Since I need to make Paul laugh, I'll tell the story. I'm having my first preventive colonoscopy on Friday, and I thought I'd come on this podcast just to start the BS flowing early.
Oh, yes.
And if that doesn't get you a Hugo nomination, Patrick, I don't know what will.
Yeah. Thanks ever so much, Larry. I appreciate that. What's your website? Welcome. What are you doing on the web?
Nothing. I'm working my tail off. I've been traveling so much. I have a security software company called Media Sorcery, and we sell secure transport software to healthcare companies, and it's going quite well, but it keeps me on the road and off the internet, which is good for some people. but it's exciting.
Okay, very cool. And Paul, you didn't throw out your Twitter this time.
I didn't. I was going to say that to the end. My Twitter is Prince Justin, that's PrinceJVstin.
And have you ever on any podcast anywhere on the web explained that?
I actually have a couple times.
Okay, because every time I've ever asked you, you've said it takes too long to explain. So point people to where they can actually get the explanation.
I'll explain it right now. All right. Well, a long time ago, back in the days of AOL, I had the screen name Justin because Justin is the middle name I always wanted but never had. I lost that screen name. And so being a fan of all things Romanophile, I changed it to Justin with a V. Moving along and combining my love of Roger Zelazny's Chronicles of Amber, which will actually be important to this podcast, I took the Twitter handle Prince Justin. So that's where you get Prince JBSTIN.
There you go. Though that's not that long of a story.
I did compress it down as much as possible.
Very cool.
I'm so happy it has nothing to do with Justin Bieber.
I was Prince Justin before Justin Bieber was.
Now
was let me not go there.
Well, they're going to deport him back up to your lovely Canada country there, so you better watch out. You're going to have company.
I don't live in Canada.
He doesn't live in Canada.
I live in Minnesota.
Oh. He just sounds like he lives in Canada.
There's a difference. I'm sorry.
Wow.
I apologize. I'm a big Green Bay Packers fan, so we all think Minnesota's part of Canada anyway.
Larry. Okay, I'm a Giants fan, so you're not gonna get a Vikings Packers rivalry out of me.
All right. Good man.
And my late friend Scott was a Packers fan, so there you go.
Good. Excellent. So I'm sure he was a wonderful person.
All I have to say is that it's Go Bears. Sarah.
Here in my town, the victory parade has shut down the entire city, and the police estimate that there are more people than actually live in Seattle currently out on the streets.
Yes, but Django, no one cares about hockey. Sarah, why don't you say hello?
Hi. I'm not that interesting. I'm Sarah. I run.
Oh!
Best tagline ever.
I'm not that interesting. I run Bookworm Blues, where I review books and I talk about stuff that nobody cares about. And I run a Special Needs and Strange World on SF Signal, and I podcast here whenever you guys let me, and I go on Twitter and I bother people, and that's pretty much me. So there you go.
Now, last week, Sarah, I actually used your read count, you know, how many books you read last year, to shame everybody else on the podcast. Because that was like 172, right?
Yeah, around there. I read 24 in January, so there you go.
Already 24 in January. Wow.
I've got some similarity with that. I got the last number at least. I've read 4 in January. I feel pretty good now.
I read about 36 spines of books in January. So I'm catching up to you there. Yeah, we'll call it that. Next up, let's say hello to Django.
Hi. I'm Django Wexler. I'm an author and I guess man about the internet. Is that a thing you can be these days?
Yes. You can be anything you want except a Seahawks fan.
Okay. Well, I'm not actually a Seahawks fan. I feel like I can't claim that because, like, I don't actually watch any games or do anything. I just happen to live in this town. There's a lot of me out there recently. So I write an anime column for SF Signal called Lost in Anime Land. I have a new novella out just this week that we're recording, but it'll be, you know, a week in the past, called John Golden Freelance Debugger, which people seem to be liking. It's on Amazon, on Kindle, and various other ebook platforms. And relevant to what you said at the beginning, I'm eligible. My novel, The Thousand Names, could be nominated for a Hugo Award for Best Novel. Probably more importantly, or more likely, because there are too many deserving novels this year. If you wanted to nominate me for the Campbell Award for Best New Science Fiction Writer, I'm eligible for that. And I'd like to mention that if you Google the Campbellian Anthology, you can download a gigantic anthology of work from everyone who's eligible for the Campbell Award, including me, and take a look at that. I highly recommend it. It's something like 800,000 words of fiction for free. It's available on Tor.com and Boing Boing and a whole bunch of other places. So if you want about 8 giant hardback books full of fiction for free, take a look.
And Sarah could read that in about, what, 6 hours, Sarah?
Something like that. She's probably read most of it already, because it's like the work that people have done all year, and she seems to keep up on things.
Well, there's a reason that Ken Liu and Sarah have never met in person, because Ken is afraid that she would be the only person who could read faster than he could write.
We should have a contest with Brandon Sanderson.
Now, I did want to throw it out there. I met Django in person, and I think he could pull off a Tierra.
Ooh,
yeah,
okay.
I think he'd rock it.
Yeah.
I'd go with that.
So I have to say, I reviewed your novella, Django, and you know that, because I think you read it. But I just want to tell the masses that you have to read it, because it's great. It's great. I love it. So there
Thank
you go.
Thank you. That's high praise, because I know your reviews can be awful tough sometimes.
Well, I loved it, and I didn't expect to love it. So there you go.
Well, thank you.
Very cool. All righty. So last but certainly not least, we have somebody who I believe would be eligible for the Fan Artist Award. And if you were in San Antonio and Worldcon and you went into the art gallery area, no doubt you didn't actually see him. Because no one came to the table, right, Jeff?
Oh, people came to the table. Plenty of people came to the table, and plenty of people saw my stuff. Nobody bought any of it.
That's so sad.
I do love the fact that right after I had the table, Galen Dara had the table, and she ended up winning the Hugo. So
and she sold some stuff, so you kept it warm for her.
Yes, I did. So I'm good luck to people. Number one, Sarah, you're not boring. Patrick doesn't have boring people on the show because that's his job. Okay. number two, Larry, just so you know, I had my colonoscopy this last summer and it was rather mediocre, but the sequel will be this summer and I'm really hoping
that's much, one of your five, Jeff. That's much, one of your five.
No, I'm going back a year. He wants me back a year later. So
the sequel will be better than the original, just like this podcast.
I certainly hope so.
Fantastic.
Hopefully that'll be the end of the series for a while. Hi, Jeff Patterson. I am at JeffPatterson11 on Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. I am one of the three horsemen hosted here on the lovely SF Signal family of podcasts. And I'm back again.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
I just love that you brought back the colonoscopy talk, because that's what people want to hear.
Of course. You got to.
Oy.
Exploring strange new territory, things in the dark. What's not to love?
That's right. Fantastic. I'm trying to figure out if mine's going to be science fiction or fantasy when I go in for it.
Oh, God.
Well, at least it won't be
rapidly
hard.
Going into dangerous places.
Yep, absolutely. That's why I come on this podcast, because we take it to places it has never gone before. Right, Patrick?
Yes, we do. And Larry, I wanted to tell you, I spent last Sunday at a lovely house in Monument, Colorado, which is a little bit south of where I live right now. And they actually had a bar with local beer on tap.
Beautiful.
And I know that you're a beer guy.
I am.
So I just thought I'd throw that out there for you. Let's go ahead and get started with our books. I'm going to give Paul a break. I'm going to let him go first. That way everybody else doesn't steal all the books on his list for a change.
Well, I don't know how likely that would be, but I appreciate getting to bat first in the lineup. Okay.
No problem. Book one.
Book one, Guns of Avalon, Roger Zelazny, the sequel to Nine Princes in Amber. Nine Princes in Amber, which is the story of an immortal family in the world of which all others are but shadows, is an awesome and excellent book. The Guns of Avalon, which continues Corwin's story as he tries to find gunpowder weapons to take over Amber, is even better.
Why?
It expands the universe. We get to meet the major, one of the major female antagonists of the series. That would be Dara. We get to expand and see much more of his multiverse world. It's got even better action than the first, and hey, it has guns in it. it's high adventure, which continues and expands the tradition from the first and adds whole new layers of mystery and character development, and we get to meet all sorts of awesome members of Corwin's family, including the greatest general of all time, even though he only has one one arm, and I just love it.
Awesome. Book two.
Book two, The Tainted City by Courtney Schaefer. Courtney is a friend of mine. I did like her Whitefire Crossing because, hey, you get to cross glaciated mountains with two interesting characters. The Tainted City shows that she's not just a mountains riding fantasy author, but she also can write secondary world urban fantasy as Dev and Kieran have to return to Dev's home city to try to stop a cataclysmic war between two kingdoms or possibly something even worse and discover the secrets behind one of the characters' pasts. It shows she's not a one-trick pony, although there are some mountain scenes towards the end, and there's some, and she shows some really interesting magic systems in the second novel.
Very cool. And there's no Anakin Skywalker. Okay.
Book three. A Discourse in Steel by Paul Kemp. This is a sequel to The Hammer and the Blade, his very Lieber Pfaffer and the Grey Mouser novel. This continues the story of the two characters as they have to basically take down an entire thieves guild in order to protect the two women they've sworn to keep safe after the events of the first novel. We get lots of character building between the two protagonists. We get to see a lot more of the city. In the first novel, we were both amazingly just shuttling in and out, never really got the sense of Durfolin, which is the city as a place. We get to see that. There's some really interesting world building, and it's sword and sorcery action. I mean, two men versus a thieves guild. How could you not like that?
I'm hearing Gollum's voice in my head going, you know, we don't like that, Precious. I don't know.
Okay.
It's the worst impersonation ever.
It's the worst impersonation ever. Next one up, the fourth one up, I will go with Lois McAsher-Bujold's Paladin of Souls, which is a sequel to The Curse of Chalion. Paladin of Souls rightfully won the Hugo Award. The Curse was nominated. It's set in her fantasy universe where there are four gods plus a fifth one, which no one really likes. This novel, instead of focusing on the main character from Curse, instead focuses on a character who was insane through most of the first novel. Her name is Ista, and we get a strong female protagonist driving events through her quote unquote pilgrimage, which is really just a cover for her going off and doing adventuring. And there's not enough novels with strong female protagonists in fantasy literature, and Bujold made it work, and we get to see a lot more about the gods and the world they like love to meddle in. And finally, I will go with The Demon in the City. This is by Liz Williams. It is a sequel to her novel Snake Agent, which is set in a quasi-futuristic, quasi-fantasy city called Singapore 3. Snake Agent is a story of Inspector Chen. Inspector Chen is an investigator of ghosts and other supernatural entities. They do exist in the world. The world does have connections with heaven and hell, and his job is to, as part of the police department, is to deal whenever matters of heaven and hell impinge upon police work. Demon of the City is the sequel, and we get to see a character introduced in Snake Agent, that's Zhu Erz. He's a demon. He's a demon of vice, and unexpectedly, through the events of the first novel, he is now part of the police department in Demon in the City, and he has to deal with being a good guy, and this is weird and strange. I'm supposed to be promoting vice, not stopping vice. And he's an awesome and excellent character, and the novel is head and shoulders above the first, especially just this whole fish out of water story that this poor demon is stuck in the city having to do good, and he just doesn't understand where it all went wrong, and he's wound up in this predicament.
Very cool.
So those are my five novels.
Awesome. I'm gonna throw something out there to bridge us between you and the next person. History Channel 2.
What?
What?
History Channel 2. It's obviously better than the first one. It's all ancient aliens and America Unearthed and. let's see. Larry, why don't you go next?
After the History Channel 2, I'm not sure that I can possibly go next, but Hold on, do you think
it's possible, as ancient alien theorists believe, that you could follow Paul on this podcast?
Yes, I do believe.
Okay.
I want to believe.
Thank you. I was close.
Go ahead, Larry.
I had the Chronicles of Amber, too, so now I'm kind of sad that I went second. but I'll make up another one.
It happens all the time on this podcast.
It does. That's all right. The first one I have, I'll try to go in chronological order. The Gods of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs, which was a sequel to A Princess of Mars. And Princess of Mars was obviously a landmark book, but as everybody knows, it was his very first novel, and it was rough. I mean, it was great, and it was a good idea, and he had lots of concepts, and he kind of shocked the world. But The Gods of Mars and The Warlord of Mars after it are just excellent books. He builds the world, and he really gets going on the concept of what life is like on Mars for John Carter.
Now, do you think there's a decent chance that Antonio Sabato Jr. and Tracy Lords will make that movie?
One can only hope. You know, there is a.
I was on mute. You're baiting me, aren't you? Yeah.
There's a huge Make a John Carter sequel group on Facebook and Twitter, and they've talked to Andrew Stanton, who is the director of the first one. And there's a book that's on my reading stack called John Carter and the Gods of Hollywood that talks about how Disney decided before the movie was even out that they were going to write it off. So they didn't put any money into marketing, and it was really a big financial decision. So it'll be interesting to see if they do continue the story. I thought the movie was not bad. It wasn't excellent, but it wasn't the trasher that they thought it was.
Yeah,
they made it out to be.
I thought it was entertaining. It you know, I know that a lot of the purists did not like it, did not care for it, but right. I enjoyed it. But the Princess of Mars movie with Antonio Sabato Jr. and Tracy Lords, oh dear God.
It's wonderful. Maybe you should just do a podcast with Jeff and I on that one, and I'll go rent it or stream it, and we can discuss that. I'm right there with you, Jeff.
What's your second book?
Second book is Children of God by Mary Doria Russell, which was a sequel to The Sparrow. And I almost didn't pick that one because I thought The Sparrow was an awesome book, but it's probably the best first encounter series of books that I've ever read. It follows a Jesuit priest who has a knack for linguistics and language, and through a bunch of different political circumstances, the church actually sponsors the building of a hollowed out asteroid ship to go make contact with the first contact that they made. And it has some pretty amazing undertones of testing the Jesuit priest's belief. And, you know, when he encounters these people, does he really understand their culture, and is it really a sign from God? But the second book just dives deep into the whole culture of the world, and some things happen to the Jesuit priest, whose name's Emilio, that makes him really question his faith and really question God. So I thought that was just an amazing book.
Very cool.
Both of them, actually.
Very cool. What about number three?
Third on my list is Happy Hour in Hell by Tad Williams, which is the sequel to The Dirty Streets of Heaven. I've reviewed both of them on FS Signal. I'm a big Tad Williams fan, except for his choice in basketball teams, which we won't get into because we don't have enough time. But Happy Hour in Hell is a... where he got his concepts of hell. And I actually asked him and tried to figure out what, you know, did he read a bunch of mythology? Did he base it on anybody in particular? And it was just a smorgasbord. I mean, you know, we're all inundated with different concepts and different depictions of hell. And his was, part of it, I just had to put the book down. It was just one of the most nasty, realistic depictions I'd ever seen. The first book was good, but the second book was really outstanding.
Hey, Paul?
Yeah?
What's the Tad Williams series that I like?
Your Memory, Sorrow, Thorn?
Yes, thank you. I tried to read the is it the Outland series?
Otherland.
Yeah. Thank you. Because I liked the Memory Thorn and
Memory in My Side
and Sorrow and I'm Crying. And I liked that one, except for the part where I was yelling at the characters because they were doing stupid things.
And, yeah, there's an idiot bowl in that series.
Yes, and then so when the Otherland thing came out, I think I bought it in hardcover, and then I started it but never finished it. And then I actually bought the ebook, and then I started it and never finished it. So I haven't gotten into anything else that he's done.
His Shadow March series, I almost put that on here because I read the first book in the Shadow March series and just kind of put the whole thing down, and then DiNardo did one of his, hey, look at the books we got. And I'm like, I recognize that book. And I grabbed the next three and just plowed through them.
Worst impression ever.
Hey, I live near DiNardo. I can do any impression. Go ahead. Ask me to do a DiNardo impression.
Do a DiNardo impression.
I don't want to. So my fourth book is Forbidden Knowledge, which is a Stephen R. Donaldson book. And it's in something called The Gap Cycle. And it's... the first book is called The Real Story, which is probably wins for the worst title of a book in the history of titles of books. And it's a it's almost – the first book is almost a character study in I've got these three people and I want them to rotate between being villains, heroes, and heroines. And they all change characteristics. And I read that book probably 3 decades ago and I was – and I like Stephen R. Donaldson. I like the Thomas Covenant series, but I put that down and kind of like the Shadow March series. I didn't pick it up until the other ones came out. And the other three, is it three books or four books in the Gap Cycle? I don't remember. But they're huge cultural, political battles of, you know, they're completely different than the first book. I'm not even sure frankly why the first book's there, except it sets up some of the characteristics of the three. But I like the rest of the series. It's a good series.
Very cool. And number five.
Well, since Zelazny was taken, I guess I'll start a large argument with a lot of people and say The Wise Man's Fear by Patrick Rothfuss. I thought that the second book, I like both books, but the second book, It made me wait and wait and wait and wait for the third book, just like the rest of the world. So I thought it was more in depth and in detail about Kavoth and about who he was and who he was growing into, and it had asked a lot more questions, left a lot of things open. So I'm hopeful we'll see the next book sometime soon.
So Django, you said uh-oh.
I just know that's a point of much contention, which of the two books is better.
Mm.
I mean, like, I might be just barely on the other side. I like them both, but I thought the first one was probably superior, but, you know, not gotcha. By much.
Gotcha.
Well, you know, this was my sixth book, but Paul really, you know, got me on the Amber Zelazny thing. Since I had to go second, I had to come up with something quick. But I agree with the Django. I like both of them, and I'm sure I'll like the third one and the fourth one and the fifth one when they come out.
Very cool. All righty. Well, let's before I go to Sarah, give Sarah a second here. Before I go to you, I did want to throw out there another sequel that I thought was pretty good. HBO 2.
Oh, God.
Is it really a second History Channel?
No, it's everything that was on that was on Cinemax 3 weeks ago.
it's no Home and Garden TV 2, though, that's for sure.
No.
It's funny, Patrick, because that's how they pitched it.
Yeah, I know. Sarah, book one.
Yes. All right. My first book would be Dead House Gates by Steven Erickson.
Oh, that's a good choice.
But
my books.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I'm feeling someone would get this one.
Yeah.
The series starts with Gardens of the Moon, which is a really, really good book, but it seems to be only a good book to people who read it the second time. It's kind of Erickson throws you into the middle of it, and the first time I read the book, I didn't know what the hell was going on the whole time. And I just kept going because I thought, this guy knows how to write. And then book two came and everything was just, it just fit. The characters had names that I understood, and the cultures were cool, and the world was big, and there was a plot I understood, and it was just amazing. And then after that, it just keeps going and getting better and better and better, and that series is amazing. But book one is definitely the weakest one of the lot.
Really?
So that's my first one.
Okay. Why is the first one the weakest?
Well, it's not necessarily the weakest. It's just hard to understand. Erikson throws you into the middle of complete chaos almost. It's this like battle scene thing, and it's huge and complex, and there's no possible way that any reader the first time through would understand what's going on. You just know a bunch of people are fighting, and somehow cards are involved, and then you just kind of move on, and that's kind of what I got out of book one.
I actually think you're definitely right that it is the weakest. I mean, it's divided between two plots that don't have much to do with each other, and it's not well put together. He tries to show off too much of the world in one volume. And the second one, he really like settles down and gets like a nice solid storyline that runs through the whole book. In fact, two, but they're related, and there's a clear plot and, you know, clear protagonists, and it really just is amazing. I think he just knocks it out of the park in that second book.
It's a depressive story in that second book, though. The march is not for the squeamish.
No, but all his stories are like that.
True.
Yeah.
You don't read those books if you're squeamish, really.
No.
All righty, Sarah, book two.
All right, my second book, I'm choosing Mockingbird by Chuck Wendig. And it's not that Blackbirds is a bad book, because the whole series, everything Chuck Wendig has ever written, made it onto my best books of 2013 list. So it's great. But I think Blackbirds, in comparison to Mockingbird, Blackbirds doesn't have as much of a sense of place, I guess. And in Mockingbirds, it really feels like he kind of establishes Miriam somewhere and gets her into the city, and she kind of broadens the flow of her actions, and it just, she affects more, and through affecting more, she's a deeper character. And I mean, book one was great, but Mockingbird floored me. It absolutely floored me. That was where Chuck Wendig kind of shows off his skill for me.
Very cool. And I get to actually hang out with him April 25th through 27th, and I'll talk about that later.
Nice.
Oh, nice. I hate you for that.
What's book number three?
My third book is kind of a whole series. It's the Rhyria, I guess that's how you say it, Revelations by Michael Sullivan. The first book is The Crown Conspiracy, and that was his first book that he ever wrote, I guess, and you can kind of tell. It's kind of stereotypical. There are a lot of first author hiccups. It's a good story, but it's something you more kind of enjoy rather than something that floors you. But as the series progresses with each consecutive book, he gets more confident in his own skill as a writer, and he writes better, the characters are more fleshed out, the world in each book expands, and it still kind of stays one of those comfortable fantasy stories, but there's nothing wrong with that. He does it really well, and as the series goes on, he just gets better and better and better. And that series ended up being one of my favorites, but it was kind of fascinating to watch the change in him as an author from that very first book to the conclusion.
Very cool. How about number three? Or number four, I'm sorry. Four.
Number four is a series by Lynn Fluelling called The Tamir Triad. It starts with the Bone Dolls twin. This isn't a trilogy that has been talked about much. I kind of feel like I'm the only person who's ever read it.
I feel the same way about The Wheel of Time, if that makes you feel any better.
I love her writing. She's kind of one of the first fantasy authors that I cut my teeth on in high school. And this is one of those trilogies that was one of my first, so it kind of has a soft spot for me. The trilogy itself is great, but in the first book, the characters are pretty young, and it might just be me, but I have a hard time connecting with 10-year-olds. I just don't. I can't do it. So the first book, in that respect, it just didn't work that well. But in the next books, the characters are older, and they're thrust into the center of this really interesting political sphere, and there's very unique magic, and it just feels more natural. Her writing feels more natural, much less forced than it was in the first one. So.
Very cool. Okay. And number five is Alive.
My last one is the Shadow Ops series by Mike Cole. He is kind of, in a lot of ways, he was kind of really interesting for me to watch as an author, because like Michael Sullivan, his first book was released, and then, you know, he just finished that Shadow Ops trilogy. But over the three books, you can really see how he's changed as an author. His first book was good, but the second book was broader, and he really brings you into the whole circumstances that are, he brings you into the middle of everything, but he keeps it unique and fresh. There are more characters, they're really believable. You care about them. It stops being an interesting story that a cool take on, you know, the army, and it starts being something that makes you think. And the last book was fabulous. I loved the last book. I thought he ended that trilogy perfectly. But it definitely gets better with each one.
Well, it's interesting because I know Paul just absolutely hated it.
Mike gave me crap for pointing out flaws in the first couple books. He said in a comment to my the throne, and he finally got a pitch past me.
No, you just recently reviewed it, right? The third one.
I did on SF Signal.
Okay, yes. Yeah. And you gave it 4.5?
I gave it a rare 4.5, yeah. I second everything Sarah said. He gets better as a writer. The first book is much more cool concept, but the second and third books, he starts bringing it all together.
Very cool. Okay, so before I move on, I did want to throw out there, I made reference to it already, but of course, obviously, oh. Short Circuit 2.
Wait, there was a Short Circuit 2?
Absolutely, yes. But they couldn't get like one. You know, Gutenberg will do anything. You just have to give him money. Or apparently Coke. I mean, either one works, and he's there. So, let's see. We've got Django and Jeff. Let's see. Your two hit is...
Wait, I have to use my magic die.
All righty. Let's go with Django.
All right. Okay. Five books. Well, so my first one was also Stephen Erickson's Dead House Gates, and that was taken. So I'll replace that from my movie list. The most obvious better sequel ever is Terminator 2, which is just so much better in every way than the original. It's a clear example of someone taking sort of schlock, like good schlock, but still schlock, and making something higher out of it.
Come with me if you want to live.
That there's it, you know, actual science fiction rather than just, you know, a horror movie. So that's great. To move on to the books.
I'm sorry. I just flashed to Kindergarten Cop. You know, I have a tumor.
It's not a tumor.
Not every phase of Arnold Schwarzenegger's career has been glorious, unfortunately. But really, I'd say very few of them have. But that was one.
I think his worst movie was Governor of California.
Yeah, the people who live in California tell me that. I've got China Meville. Has written a great many books now, but the first book that aside from some short story collections, was called Perdido Street Station, set in his Basslag universe. And while very good, it's perhaps a little overindulgent in terms of world design and description, and it's kind of slow, and a lot of people I know have a hard time getting through it. His second book, The Scar, I thought was just absolutely fantastic. It's got a solid plot. It's got a great setting that's not, like, overly hammered in, but still wonderful. It's got great fantasy stuff, good characters. It's one of my favorites of books of all time, but also of his writing. And so that definitely belongs on this list. He doesn't write many sequels anymore, so that was the only one of those.
Okay. And I believe is it China Mieville? Is how they pronounce it.
I don't know. Okay. I should know because I've listened to his audiobooks, but I forget. China and not like China.
Yeah, if he would ever come on the podcast, I could tell you, but I digress.
I'd be intimidated. He looks intimidating in his author photos. He looks kind of like intense, scary kind of guy. But
so does Terry Goodkind, but I don't care.
Yeah. I met Terry Goodkind. He was nice.
Yeah, did he apologize for insulting everybody?
I did not bring that up.
That was wise of you.
It was only for about 60 seconds, so yes. I can't really say I got into a deep conversation.
Okay.
The theme of this list, I guess, is sequels that are even better than books that are already really good.
Yes, and that doesn't mean that the first book can't be awesome. It's just that the second book was awesomer.
Well, and so in that vein, Joe Abercrombie obviously wrote the First Law trilogy and then has been going on with that. And I enjoyed the First Law trilogy a great deal, obviously. It's great. But I thought the first standalone book he wrote after that, Best Served Cold, was just amazing. It would be on my top list of best science fiction books ever. It has just great characters. It's one of the few books that has a very strong... I'm trying not to sound like super pretentious here. It has a very strong central metaphor. Like, you can tell what the theme of the book is, but it's also a really good read. Like, it's hard to pull both of those off at once to make it something that is both strongly themed and also, you know, exciting and a good read. So I couldn't say enough good things about that. Number three, I'd go with Ellen Kushner's The Privilege of the Sword. I guess this is actually number four, if you count Terminator 2. Another series that I really like, the first book is Swords Point. I don't know if a lot of people know these books. They're kind of fantasy, like there's no magic, but they take place in the secondary world. And the first one is these two swordsmen who are in love, and they run around the city, and it's fun. But the second one, she does this sort of coming of age story of this girl as she's being trained to be a sword fighter, and it worked for me in a really, really neat way. And so I really like that one.
Very cool.
The last one on my list, Sarah Monette wrote a series that starts with, now I'm forgetting what it starts with, what the first book is. The second
book
one is the, what?
Book one.
Book one?
Is it Melusine?
It's Melusine. One? And then the second one is The Virtue.
Yeah.
Which were both good. But I thought the third book, The Mirador, she brings in a third point of view character. And it somehow balances the book. She brings in a woman to be a point of view character along with the two men who are the sort of previous points of view. And it balances the book out in a really good way. And I thought that was just much stronger for me than the previous two entries in that series, which was a really pleasant thing because I had been reading it and it was good. And then I picked up the third one and I was like, wow. This is great. So that's my list.
Okay. And just to throw out there what I said, you asked you said you didn't remember where it started, and I said it started with book one.
Yeah. Oh, I see. I thought you had said the name and I
Mm-mm.
missed it.
Mm-mm.
We all heard you. We were just trying to kind of let it slide,
I know.
Patrick.
I know, but I will bring you back.
So what, as an unpretentious sort, Django, what was the theme of Best Served Cold?
the theme of the book is about whether it is possible for people to change, right? That is the central question that drives virtually all the characters. It drives Shivers, it drives everybody, and they all get an answer to it in one way or another.
Very cool. Awesome. Alrighty. Well, thanks everybody for coming. Oh, Jeff.
Oh.
Hi, Jeff.
I just got to say that the continued existence of our host Patrick Hester Django is proof that no, people cannot change.
You know, and I just want to throw it out there that I always appreciate Jeff being able to come on when John Stevens can't.
I am his paler, taller shadow.
We're glad you're here, Jeff.
Paler.
Yeah. I am the palest man in Christendom, trust me. You know, Patrick, when you sent me this email, I immediately said, I've got to put a Mike Resnick book on here. And I was really torn. Santiago and Widowmaker both have excellent sequels, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized it's not even so much that I think they're better, it's just that I think they're kind of even and on par. It's almost like he went out of his way not to make a better sequel, just to make one as good. So I'm not going to list either of those two. Five books. These are all novels, and I'm going not quite old school, but older school. I'm going to start with Clay's Ark by Octavia Butler from her Patternist series. I was really torn on this one because even though Pattern Master was her first book, it was the last chronologically in the sequence about, in short, alien influence on human genetics, going back to the time of ancient Egypt and going into the far future, which is when Pattern Master takes place. Clay's Ark, I believe, was the third book that came out chronologically, or third book that came out publishing-wise, and it takes place in a near future of the late 70s, if I remember correctly. And it involves the first discovery of alien life, and the otherness which she brought to this book was something kind of unique, because we had already seen where it all leads to in Pattern Master, which was just chock full of all kinds of examples of the other, wherein Clay's Ark sort of brought it in for the first time, and we saw it with fresh eyes, and it was really, really terrifying. It truly was. My second and third one, I didn't realize how close they were related until I actually started thinking about it. The second one I'm going to go with City on Fire by Walter John Williams. It was the sequel to Metropolitan, which was Williams' response to the entire subgenre of urban fantasy. He wanted to make a fantasy where every element of the fantastic was a direct result of the urban setting, as opposed to just transposing unicorns into downtown Des Moines. Thank you. It had to do with the fact that there's this very large, massive city, and it's run by this thing called plasm, and plasm is sort of this energy that is generated by urban development. And it had to deal with a woman named Aya who falls in love, or falls in lust, basically, with this guy named Constantine, who's a one of the leaders, visionaries of the city. And Metropolitan was a really good book. City on Fire really ramped up the stakes, showed us some more of the more unsavory denizens of the city, and just hammered home a lot better.
And there's no telegraphing that anything weird is going to happen when you are involved with someone named Constantine.
Not at all. not a bit.
One of my roommates is named Constantine.
Ooh.
Is he British? Is he British, and does he smoke a lot?
No, he's Russian.
Oh.
Ooh.
And he doesn't smoke. Vodka. But weird things do happen around him on a regular basis.
Third book, Estival Tide by Elizabeth Hand, sequel to Winterlong. Winterlong does not get enough credit for the impact it had on contemporary new weird, in my opinion. And it gave us a city, and it gave us this almost Oz-like adventure through dying slash dead city of Orsinus. And Estivaltide took place much later, when the city itself, which is domed, is now being threatened by a unknown horror that exists in the ocean beyond. It is an ensemble cast. There are a ton of subplots. No synopsis I can do would give it justice. There's just all kinds of real crazy magic-like and evil-like entities wandering around. And it is just... And her early books especially, this is not to take away from her later stuff, because I love stuff like Mortal Love and things like that, but her language in those... there was a third book to it as well, Icarus Descending, and her language in those books was clearly Delaney-esque, and it really showed in the second book.
Very cool.
I'm going to dip a little bit farther back with Fred Pohl's Beyond the Blue Event Horizon, the sequel to Gateway. And I want to explain my choice here.
Yeah, please do.
I love Gateway. Gateway was a seminal book in my really developing a love for science fiction when it came out in the 70s. And when I read Beyond the Blue Event Horizon, I saw that he was really trying to widen the scope of everything. But something else I noticed in my reread about 5 years ago was the fact that the first book, even though it had such an amazing sense of wonder, was kind of dimmed a little bit during the course of the story by the fact that the protagonist is just such a dismally depressing character. At least that's the way I took it when I first read it. And it colored the narrative in my mind. Beyond the Blue Event Horizon, with the discovery of this other ship and the fact that this kid might have been alive longer than they expected, and the fact that there might actually be true transluminal drive and the galaxy is a bigger place than anybody thinks it might be, full of wonders and terrors, etc., is hammered home because of the fact that so much really bad stuff happens to the character, but he's starting to realize now how much is at stake. And when I went back and reread Gateway, it dawned on me that he was kind of sleepwalking through that book almost. And that wasn't the case in the second book. And when I did my reread, I actually found myself enjoying Blue Event Horizon more than Gateway.
Paul, rebuttal?
I'm going to have to reread Blue Event Horizon, obviously, so I can properly respond to this. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, for sheer rollicking adventure-y stuff, you can really go with Hichi Rendezvous, but the Gateway books are never really about rollicking adventure, so it just had the most impact for me.
Interesting. Okay.
And last book on my list, Anvil of Stars by Greg Bear, the sequel to Hammer of God. Hammer of God.
Forge of God, you mean?
Huh?
Isn't it Forge of God?
Forge of God. I'm sorry. What did I say? Hammer of God.
You said Hammer of God. You're done.
That was Arthur C. Clarke. Forge of God. Thank you. Hammer and Anvil. My brain is shot. This Kirkland brand scotch, by the way, from Costco is really good. It's $20 if you can get it. Pick yourself up a bottle.
Kirkland's vodka is good too, brother.
I've heard that. So, Forge of God, through a series of highly unlikely events, the Earth gets destroyed. The Earth being destroyed is pretty much the last quote unquote 20 minutes of that book. And it is a pretty exciting thing. Anvil of Stars deals with what happens later. And it's basically a story of long planned out revenge. The entities that have been going around wiping out worlds have had this group that has been after them, and they kind of co-opt the survivors of each of the planets to go looking for them. And the child of one of the characters in Forge is on the ship of avenging entities who are looking for these destroyers and managed to encounter one. Strangely enough, when I did the reread of Anvil of Stars, I want to say 2 years ago, it was right after I had done my reread of Blindsight by Peter Watts. And the two books, even though they're not similar style, thematically, whatever, just in the way their story arcs kind of play out, they kind of hit a lot of the same notes in a similar rhythm. There's a lot of discussion about what's actually going on. And I really, really liked it. I think it acts as a standalone book. It has a lot of added weight when you consider the horrible things that happened in the first book. But it is a sequel that shares nothing except for a little bit of genetic material with the first book, and is really visceral in exploring the concepts of advanced races and advanced intelligences having to embrace the concept of vengeance just out of survival. So,
all good stuff, Jeff.
I do what I can.
You do. Now, it's already been going on the thread here that our list is actually creating it's like exponentially growing the to-be-read lists of people, because it's sequels. No one wants to start the sequel, so they're going to have to read the first one and then the sequel. I find that amusing.
Well, and you know, as I listen to everybody's talking about the first book being good, but the second book being better, and you never will get to the sequel if the first book sucks.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, occasionally you might. I mean, you might buy the first and second book at the same time.
And then you have to be stubbornly persistent, or at least more stubbornly persistent than I am. I mean, if the first book sucks, I won't go for the second.
So I'm going to throw some out there. We already talked about some great movies like Highlander 2: The Quickening. I wanted to also throw out there some other sequel movies that were kind of good. Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
No.
Transformers 2.
To be fair, I think Last Crusade is the best of the Indiana Jones movies by a long way.
It is. I'm joking now. Temple of Doom.
But it is really a sequel. So.
Yes, it is. And it is one of the better ones. But then after that, they did the Ghost Skulls things. Matrix 3. G.I. Joe 2. You couldn't think it could possibly get any worse, and you were wrong.
I was going to say, like, can G.I. Joe 2 really be worse than the first one? I didn't see it.
Fantastic Four 2.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was Fantastic 42. I got that one messed up.
Transformers 2.
I said Transformers 2, yes. Prometheus. Sort of a pseudo-sequel, but yeah, that was horrible. I want to throw some books out there just in case people wanted to take me seriously for a second. I'm going to say that The Vampire Lestat is better than Interview with a Vampire.
I would agree with you.
Yeah, that was on my list.
You know, that was something Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, man. I was also going to put her on my list, but it's impossible to pick out of those books.
Mm. So. I will also go on record in saying that The Great Hunt is better than The Wheel of Time.
I was going to ask you, you mean The Eye of the World?
Eye of the World, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, Patrick, if you thought that.
I did, because that's the first point when really they're all going off their separate ways, and we get some little mini stories, and we get some of the best of Matt at being sick in that one. Because he's still kind of twitchy, and so yeah, I like that one a lot. He's tied to the horn, and that's great. What do we think? Is A Clash of Kings better?
In some ways, I would say yes, especially because we get to see Melisandre, and I love Melisandre.
I think A Storm of Swords could firmly say it's probably the best in the series so far.
Okay. How about The Two Towers?
because of its story structure in terms of the book, no, I don't. And that's really just one book divided into three parts. That's not really a sequel.
But here's the thing. The Two Towers, I enjoy that because Strider and the elf and the dwarf run off on their own, you know, trying to find the little halflings.
Yeah, but there's in The Two Towers, there's that part where they're with the Ents and they just go on and on and on. It's so boring.
My room, my room.
No. I mean, it was long in the movie, and they cut out at least 30 hours of enting. So I was just like, thank you.
Please send your hate mail, too.
Yes, exactly. What about the Discworld books? I think the sequels got progressively better.
That was on my list, but I couldn't really pick out specific books. But yeah, there's a sort of closer to the recent books, they've gotten really good.
Paul?
The first few Discworld books are just pastiches and basically making fun of fantasy, and then I think it's probably like around Guards. Pratchett decided, I can start really writing really good novels set in this universe. And then he starts getting better and better as he starts exploring the various threads, the guards, the witches, death. And then later on, the more recent ones, the Industrial Revolution ones. Yeah. But those first few, yeah, you can bounce off of those and never go back to Discworld. And that's a shame.
I've only read a few of the Discworld books, but I've read The Colors of Magic, I think the first one. And Guards, and Small Gods, and totally different. Between Guards, and The Color of Magic, the writing is just so different.
It's different amazing. In a good way? Different in a good way, though.
It's better later in the series. I liked Guards, and Small Gods is probably my favorite book ever written in the history of the world. But the Colors of Magic just didn't even work for me.
I agree. How is it that you like that so much and haven't read like all the rest of the Discworld books?
Because I get so damn confused. There's too many of them. I don't know. And then I ask people, well, which one should I read next? And you ask 10 people and they'll have about 12 different answers.
Yeah,
well, you
precisely.
Should start here, but you could start on this one. But maybe this one would work better. I don't know. Until someone makes up their mind, I'm just giving up on the whole thing.
A friend of mine compared it to trying to figure out how to introduce a person to Zappa. Where do you start them? There's just way too much.
Make these graphs. Oh, look at this picture. It's a graph. It'll help you so much. And everyone has a graph, and all the graphs are different. I just don't know. Terry Pratchett needs to write me a letter and tell me how to read his damn series.
when he was guest of honor at NoriseCon, I think that was one of the panels, was actually what order to read his books. And you know, he would let somebody else on the panel give their theory, and then he would shoot it down. And he shot down everybody's reading order solely for the sake of shooting down their reading order, just to muddy the waters, you know?
That's funny.
The problem is that they're not all strict sequels, so like you can start. No one would suggest reading The Wheel of Time book 5 before book 1, right?
Well, like, then you get into these philosophical discussions with the Discworld fan people, and they'll tell you that they're not, you know, exact, like, sequences of each other. They're individual series in a series, and philosophically this little series goes better before this series. And I'm like, then why the hell did he write that one before the other one? I don't get it. I love this series. I don't get it.
Sarah, I'm curious because I'm one of the people who have recommended some things to you to read. Did you ever pick up the Soprano Sorceress?
I have.
And did you like it or did you hate it?
I'm kind of middle of the road on it.
Okay. Because I do like the Spellsong War, I think, is the second book in that one as well. And that was pretty good.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I don't know.
I'll also throw out that Full Moon from Jim Butcher was better than Stormfront.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I could buy that.
And I believe Stormfront was actually written for a creative writing class. So that was like his first foray into writing long fiction. And then obviously it got published, and then he had to figure out, you know, writing books. So Full Moon, much better, I think, than Stormfront. I'm surprised no one mentioned like the Foundation books.
Well, that's
a while.
Once again, that's kind of tough, you know?
I mean, they started off as novellas that were compiled together and put into a trilogy for publishing purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there were some sequels to them, both by him and other authors, which is a totally separate subject because there was a couple sequels by other authors I was going to bring up as well. And it's rough territory to go into, you know.
Okay. What about Gene Wolfe, like the Book of the New Sun?
Again, that's tough.
Yeah.
Especially because those books just build on each other. I mean, you could also go with the Wizard Knight. Is the wizard better than the knight? But can you read the wizard without reading the knight? Gene Wolfe is hard work as it is, trying to figure out whether the books are better than the ones in the earlier series is even harder to figure out.
Okay.
You know, something else just dawned on me too. I'm actually going to go back when I listen to this podcast. I'm going to add up how many of the books that were mentioned were sequels to the author's first actual novel, not just to a novel.
Oh, good one.
I know Estival Tide, Winterlong was Hand's first novel, and I think the Pattern Master, I think, was Butler's first novel, wasn't it?
Was it?
I gotta go look.
And now you've stumped everybody, Jeff.
To the internet.
Yes. All righty, Django, was there something you were trying to say there?
The Perdido Street Station, what that I mentioned was, I don't know if it was his first novel, but it was certainly his first big release novel.
I think
China Meville.
His first full novel. Yeah.
So I mentioned that I get to hang out with Chuck Wendig. That's basically I've been invited to be the official podcaster at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference, and that is April 25th through 27th in Colorado Springs. If you are a author who is interested in a writers conference, this might be the one for you. Go check it out. PikesPeaksWriters.com is the website. And
you grow your beard and have a beard contest?
I guess I might have to, yeah. I wonder if we can get Gail to join us, because Gail's going to be there as well, Gail Carriger. And Jim Hines is going to be there. There's a bunch of people that are going to be there, and I'm actually going to be doing interviews for SF Signal. So
nice.
That's going to be kind of cool. Like I said, PikesPeaksWriters.com is the website. Go check that out if anybody's interested.
Do me a favor. Just get out of the lobby once in a while. Go walk around.
We'll see.
Such a wallflower at these things.
Hey, Jeff. This one has an absinthe party.
Ooh.
Uh-oh. Temptation.
Yeah.
All right.
If you ever want to experience absinthe without doing it, take some Ouzo and pop a couple of Altoids, and you're good.
All righty. Let's go through and do some final thoughts here. Sarah, anything else you want to tell our folks that are listening?
No. Thank you for letting me rant.
No problem.
I do that almost every time I'm on here.
Sorry. That's okay. No, it's entertaining. Everybody loves it. Django, any final thoughts? You want to tell people anything you're doing and anything upcoming?
You know, as always, I'm on Twitter at Django Wexler. You know, I hope people check out this new novella, and then my next book comes out in April, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Very awesome. Cool.
That's the Forbidden Library. I should mention it.
So then no one can get it?
No. The book is, in fact, available, not forbidden. I can see how that would be confusing.
Yeah, that's like the real story. You got to watch out, Django, for those titles.
I bought this book, The Real Story, and it's not nonfiction. I'm suing.
It's not a real story. Crap.
Larry, any final thoughts?
Well, my new project is to go collect all of the nominatable SF Signal people so that we can have a cabal and nominate each other for Hugo Awards. I think that would be a great test of the Hugo voting process,
such as it robes, is. You know.
Sign me up.
Very cool. And Paul?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter as Prince J. Viston. Come chat me, and I will chat at you back, because God knows I don't tweet enough.
And Jeff,
I need more bourbon.
I figured you did. Yeah, we ran a little bit long, so I appreciate everybody coming on. Thank you. And if you are listening to this podcast and you have five sequels that we should know about, please list them in the comments. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah. Thinking and crap.
And scene.